This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When we're doing our campaign, sometimes people say, well, you've got to micro-target the consumer. And I actually say, no, we don't have to micro-target the consumer. We have to target the people around the consumers who are going to put pressure on the consumers to change, because ultimately an advert that we do is much less likely to have an impact on somebody than their grandchild saying to them, don't do it anymore.
Have you ever seen one of those ads with a celebrity like Jackie Chan or Leonardo DiCaprio beside a beautiful, rare animal? If so, there's a good chance it was promoting a WildAid campaign. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with the CEO of WildAid, Peter Knights, about the organization's mission to protect endangered species. We explore the challenges of trying to globally ban the trade of ivory, discuss the methods they use to curb the demand for rare animals, particularly in China, and hear an update on the status of the totoaba, a rare fish whose bladder is sometimes referred to as aquatic cocaine because of the astronomical price it fetches on the black market. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Peter Knights. He's the CEO and co-founder of WildAid. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fabulous. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Why don't you first give an overview briefly for our listeners? What is WildAid's mission?
Well, our mission is to end the illegal trade in wildlife within our lifetimes. And we've given ourselves a little bit of time. It's obviously not an easy problem to solve. And it's a bit like a many-headed hydra. You cut one head off and another head appears somewhere else. So we've had quite a lot of success with some species, but people's imagination is forever finding new types of animals and plants to trade illegally. So it's a tough mission, but we have been seeing some very significant progress, particularly in Asia, where the economic boom has led to an increase in the demand for a lot of these products. But there's been a fairly fast awareness raising over there as well. And a lot of the public now very supportive of conservation efforts.
And you were able to ally yourselves with some pretty big names in some of your campaigns over the years. One that comes to mind is this project you've worked on with Yao Ming, the retired NBA basketball star from China, in trying to implement an ivory ban domestically in China. Why don't you first kind of tell us the genesis of that campaign and where it is today?
Well, the methodology we've developed is that, you know, environmental news is very often not very good news. It's often bad news, and people get fairly sick and tired of hearing bad news the whole time. So we've tried to sugarcoat the hard news that people really need to know with some star power and some celebrity power to try and make it more digestible, if you like, so people are engaged. You know, you get a much bigger audience, and there's not much point forever preaching to the choir of people who may watch National Geographic and Discovery. You've got to reach people that wouldn't necessarily get access to that type of news. So working with Yao Ming and Jackie Chan, that kind of people, has been one of our methodologies of how we've done this. And when Yao Ming retired in 2011, I always say it was basketball's loss but WildAid's gain, because he then had a little bit more time. He'd already been working with us on shark fin and various other issues, but then he had time to actually come with us to Africa, which is something I'd asked him to do for quite a long time, to see for himself, because he's a very smart and articulate guy. He obviously has kind of a cult status in China. He was kind of symbolized the rise of China playing in the NBA here, and a fantastic spokesperson. So I wanted him to get the firsthand experience. So when he retired, he was able that next year to go to Kenya and South Africa with us. And this was 2011, which was right when the poaching was really at its peak in Africa, as a result from the reopening of ivory trade. So ivory trade had been closed in 1989. Elephants had started to recover. Then in 2008, there'd been a big push to reopen the ivory trade, which supposedly to be very tightly regulated. However, what had happened was that the opening of the trade sort of opened the floodgates and the controls were not working. And the poaching went up to about 33,000 elephants a year across Africa. And so we took Yao, to Kenya to see for himself. And the reality was a lot of documentaries had been made for the West and National Geographic, etc. There had been no documentaries made in China on the poaching crisis. So we produced the first documentary about poaching led by Yao Ming. So it was just after his retirement. So people were able to get an insight into Yao's character. I spoke to my China office yesterday and they said they're still showing this documentary with Yao, where he went to sort of meet elephants, learn about their behavior, learn about their intelligence, meet some of the orphans. And then on one very sad day, we took him out and he saw five carcasses of dead elephants that had been killed by poaching. And we did a whole public service announcements campaign, Emmy-nominated documentary, and the first documentary to be shown in China about the poaching crisis. And that, I think, awakened a lot of people there to what was going on and the obvious role in China as the end market. And so the Chinese government that had been actually selling ivory up to that time actually sort of changed its position and destroyed 7.5 tons of confiscated ivory, and the first time they'd ever done that very publicly. And then the US government was also instrumental in engaging China to ultimately in 2017 it came in to ban the domestic sales of ivory. And as soon as they announced that they were going to end domestic sales of ivory, the price of ivory went down by about 2/3 and the imports to China went down. So even the announcement that there was going to end the trade ended a lot of the speculation which was driving the poaching in Africa. And it's not done, but it's way down on what it was.
When I saw that, I was thinking that it would have the opposite effect, that prices would go up because of more scarcity. But that's not the case, huh?
Well, for my sins, I studied economics at university. And the thing is, if you do not shift the demand curve and you just restrict the supply, then yes, the price will go up. But the act of banning, the public education campaign that we did around it, in the first year of the campaign, there was a 50% increase in awareness of poaching in China. So people had assumed that the ivory had come from elephants dying of natural causes. Once they found out it was from poaching, this really turned people off ivory. And the other part of the ivory market is a lot of it is speculative. So a lot of it was not for immediate sale, but to hold on to it for the future. Now, obviously, if there is no legal market in the future, the speculative value of ivory goes down dramatically. So we were able to push the price down because the education awareness made this so much less of a desirable thing. And the fact there was no future sales in 10, 20 years because it was banned also reduced the desirability and its value as an investment. I mean, people were essentially buying ivory as an investment like they might buy a gold bar. And so they were speculating effectively on the extinction of the elephant down the line. So we've seen this before where, the people say, well, if you stop the supply, the price will just go up. It will, unless in stopping that supply, you are educating people not to want the product in the first place. And that's obviously the long-term ideal solution, is to make this thing not desirable. And that was very much what happened. Yao Ming led it, but there were many other celebrities participated as well. People like Li Bingbing. We had a massive campaign in China with billboards. People like Prince William, David Beckham, and Yao Ming did a PSA together. We had over $200 million worth of donated media space from Chinese media all supporting the cause and the backing of the government. So this was a massive education campaign, effectively.
Would an apt analogy then be comparing, let's say, the oil market or a commodities market, which then gets extinguished by, in this case, China shutting down its ivory trade, versus, let's say, a drug trade?
The big reason we haven't succeeded in drugs is because we put all our eggs in the enforcement basket and we haven't done anything to reduce the demand. And a lot of that, I think we spent something like $23 trillion on trying to fight the drugs trade. And I would argue this methodology that at least a proportion of that money should go into stopping the demand, be that through treatment of addicts, be it through, decriminalizing cannabis. But basically, to focus on reducing the demand, not trying to restrict the supply, because that's what they've done with drugs, to try to restrict the supply. It hasn't worked. And in fact, the prices, have been buoyant and the demand is still there. So, I think what we've said is you've got to impact the demand. And people had assumed wrongly, and I think, to be honest, actually somewhat racistly, if that's a word, that people in Asia would not be prepared to change. But my personal experience of working a long time in Asia was that when people had the right information, they found it very horrible to be involved in this business. And so it's largely an education campaign, which when people understood that the elephants were dying in horrible ways and that elephants are very social animals and things, they didn't want any part of the ivory trade. But nobody had explained this to them. Nobody had told them this. So it was just very much an education and awareness campaign.
So more than the drugs trade, what I was thinking is the black market, fine art. If you don't have a place to sell this art, you know, if let's say you steal a Van Gogh, yes, the price of this painting may be extremely high, but there's no viable commodities market for you to shop it around.
There's that element. There's also that, you know, I liken it sometimes to the stolen good market. So when we have a legal ivory trade, illegal ivory is able to flow through that trade in disguise. And it's almost impossible to stop. And that's been the experience with ivory. Every time we've had a legal trade, it hasn't satisfied the demand. It's provided a conduit for the illegal trade to flow through. And once you stop that conduit, then you get much less flow through of the illegal trade. So the idea that you would just be able to have this trade legally controlled just has not worked. And there's too much incentive to go around the controls. And at the end of the day, the public didn't care whether the ivory was from legal or illegal sources. And the complicated systems of tracking that they had, the public wasn't interested in them at all. So it was very much a bureaucratic exercise. And what we just saw is this massive laundering operation. So if you close that laundering operation, it becomes a lot harder. And, you know, any ivory on sale is illegal. It's obviously very hard to do it. If some is legal and some isn't, who's the person who's, you know, distinguishing between the legal and illegal stuff? So it was a mess. And we've had that with other wildlife trades. So closing it down sent a clear message to the public. It closed those loopholes for laundering. And we saw in Kenya, for example, the poaching was up like 390 elephants a year when we were there. And it went down now to, I think it was 60 last year. So there's been some fairly dramatic drops. It hasn't eliminated everywhere. There's places like Mozambique where they're fairly lawless. There's still ivory trade going on. Some of the trade has switched to places like Vietnam out of China, and Chinese tourists are buying it in Vietnam. So we're working now there on that. So overall, there's been a big improvement as well across Southeast Asia, with governments actually, you know, arresting people now for doing this, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, it was going on, but nobody was getting arrested or caught or penalized. Now they are being penalized. So we've seen an upsurge in seizures, but we think that's mainly due to more enforcement activity as opposed to an upsurge in the trade, which seems to have gone down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the CEO and co-founder of WildAid, Peter Knights. So, Peter, we were speaking about the ivory trade and specifically in China. China recently announced a major bust in the Totuaba smuggling ring. We covered this recently on Sea Change Radio when we were examining the vaquita, a rare dolphin in the Sea of Cortez, which is being imperiled by the demand for Totuaba. Their bladders are desired in the Chinese market for some reason. Why don't you kind of give us an update on where things stand right now in the Totuaba smuggling world?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we only came to this very late, this whole issue. We were involved like 2 or 3 years ago. We were approached by someone who sees anything we could do about China. Sadly, the relevant Chinese authorities didn't know about the whole Totuaba situation. So China had a fish called the Bahaba, which was had these very big swim bladders like the Totoaba, and that was driven to near extinction. And so suddenly the traders switched to getting these dried fish swim bladders from the Totoaba in Mexico. But there was never a big awareness of this within the Chinese government. So this trade is basically going on without the knowledge of China at all, even though the traders were busily taking these Totoaba. And when they catch the Totoaba, they, of course, drown the vaquita. That's the problem. But Totoaba itself is also endangered. So when we were asked to get involved, we contacted the authorities and explained to them what the situation was. And they were genuinely surprised because these species have been listed for like 25 years. So this is not like a new campaign that suddenly there's an awareness about it. But they did start to take action. They warned everybody against not selling this product. And that seemed to reduce the availability in China quite significantly. But now they've actually ratcheted up where they made a bust. I think it was like 14 people in a smuggling ring with some 800 kilos of Totoaba bladders. So they've just had their first major law enforcement operation, which is great. I mean, it might be too late for the vaquita because the vaquita is down to such low numbers now. Its survival is very much in doubt, even if we have a fantastic effort internationally. But it is very welcome that they have actually taken this enforcement action and hopefully be followed up by more action. And Chinese customs in general in the last 4 or 5 years have become way more involved in endangered species protection. There clearly has been a decision that they need to make this a major part of their activities. So whether it's seizing ivory, Totoaba bladders, pangolins, there's a lot more activity going on from Chinese customs. And it always makes the news now as well and gets a lot of coverage in China. So there's a lot more awareness now of illegal wildlife trade and that there are serious penalties involved in if you carry it out.
So WildAid is obviously a relatively small organization and China is an enormous government. What third parties do you usually engage with to try to work effectively with such a behemoth like China?
We work with the different ministries involved, customs and police. We now do quite a lot of work with. Again, there's been a real sea change, if I can steal your title.
No copyright there.
Before, customs, you know, really didn't want to work with NGOs and especially not foreign NGOs. And it was kind of just leave us, we're doing our thing. Now there's very welcome partnerships. We do, workshops with them. They really want the information to be able to do their job better. And so there's a much better rapport now. And, you know, they use international NGOs as a source of intelligence and things like that. Really how it's been working here in the States for a long time. But it's been really good to watch those agencies really open up and also, I think, get a sense of satisfaction from making these busts and seizures of wildlife and do their part in the whole thing. I mean, our main partner in China is the media, obviously. And so we've had a great relationship with CCTV, their national TV network, Xinhua, the state news agency. But very clearly, there is a strong will from the top down in China to not be the bad guys on wildlife and to take what action they can to try and help the international community. And, you know, I know we were going to talk about there was recently an announcement they were going to reopen trade in rhino horn and tiger bone. Which somehow got through the system. It sort of blindsided everybody in the non-government community, sort of came from nowhere. But thankfully, there was quite a strong backlash against this, not just from international conservationists, but also the public in China who were like, why the hell are we doing this? And the position was reversed and they've maintained and actually strengthened the ban on rhino horn and tiger bone. And I think this reflects a new attitude in China, which is one of being a good global citizen in these elements of wildlife and not wanting to be the bad guys and realizing that, you know, while a few people may profit from these businesses, ultimately the whole world and China's international image suffer. And so that was very encouraging to see that was then thrown out and they have maintained the ban and indeed expanded the ban on tigers to cover tiger skins. So there has been, I think, a big attitudinal change and ivory ban was part of that. The action on reversing the reversal on tiger bone and rhino horn. And just the public in general is very interested in these issues, very concerned. Whenever something on pangolins comes up, there's a massive outcry on social media against wildlife trade. And that reflects a huge attitudinal change in society in China.
Yes, I can't help but think public perception could also be affected for the good if we can see more scientific research poo-pooing some of the efficacy of a tiger bone or rhino horn. I mean, a lot of these are like male enhancement supplements. This is in the age of Viagra, and we're still hunting down these very rare, beautiful creatures to try to help male enhancement or whatever the cause might be. Has China paid for like their NIH, their National Institute of Health, trying to inform the public on how useless some of these wonder drugs might actually be?
Well, but you are there seeking to use rationality to persuade people who didn't arrive at their original decision through rationality.
Right.
I mean, I think rationality would tell you, for example, in Vietnam, that if rhino horn really cured cancer, then the big pharmaceutical companies would have, you know, captured its properties or using it and happening. You know, it's not a rational decision. It's more an emotional one. So yes, we can present that information. And rather than saying it's not efficacious, what we've tried to do is just say, in the case of rhino horn, it's keratin. We're not going to say whether it works or not. You've got to make your own judgment about that. But it's keratin, as your fingernails is, as your hair is, as buffalo horn is. You know, work it out for yourself. Do you really think this is going to cure cancer? And that seems to have been very effective in Vietnam in just persuading people. And I've had it parroted back to me. It's like, you know, it's fingernail. What, of course, it's not going to cure cancer. So rather than taking the thing head on and saying, oh, you know, there's a danger that, you know, traditional medicine is a hugely used system. And the last thing I think the government there wants to do is undermine the faith in that system. However, there are a lot of doctors who are also just say, look, we don't need this. You know, let's not even get into whether it works or not. We just don't need it. We have other things that are sustainable and cheaper that do the job just as well. So we just don't need to do it. So, you know, there are some things in like bear bile, for example. There is a compound which has now been synthesized and used in Western medicine. So it's not that all of this is rubbish. I mean, I think the tiger situation is purely based on the power of the animal. Rhino horn in large quantities does mildly reduce fever, but so does, you know, Advil. So you know, there's ways of trying to deal with this that don't necessarily try and undermine the credibility of that system, but actually, you know, just present information that rhino horn is keratin. And so therefore, you know, it's not very likely to have any effect. I think most people can see that rationally. So that's changing. The availability of Western alternatives changes things as well. I mean, if you didn't have Advil and now you do, that obviously might affect what you use to cure a hangover, a headache. So that's having a big impact as well. And it's basically just people's consciousness of being aware that whether it works or not, you don't want to be responsible for the extinction of those animals. And, you know, so that very often comes, interestingly, from the younger generation up, just as I think we've seen smoking reduced by people's children telling them they don't want their parents to die because of lung cancer of smoking. We've seen children in Asia telling their parents, you can't do this anymore because you're destroying the rhinos. Or the sharks, and that seems to have a big impact. So when we're doing our campaign, sometimes people say, well, you've got to micro-target the consumer. And I actually say, no, we don't have to micro-target the consumer. We have to target the people around the consumers who are going to put pressure on the consumers to change, because ultimately an advert that we do is much less likely to have an impact on somebody than their grandchild saying to them, don't do it anymore.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the CEO of WildAid, Peter Knights. So, Peter, we've been focusing on China and the consumer market. Let's switch our discussion to some of the supply side. Most recently, you went on a trip to Zimbabwe with the actress Danai Gurira, who American moviegoers and TV watchers might know from The Walking Dead and Black Panther. Explain how a country like Zimbabwe approaches anti-poaching from a methodological standpoint.
Well, mostly they're doing patrolling and things. They are doing some intelligence-based work. And what we're trying to do there with Danai is to really get the public supportive of this anti-poaching work, to provide information, intelligence on, you know, if very often the poachers are not from a community, they're coming into a community to go through and poach, and, you know, they can alert the authorities to stop that. So the slogan we used for that campaign there, and it's not just Zimbabwe, we've been doing stuff in Kenya with Lupita Nyong'o, in Uganda, Tanzania, Gabon, with local celebrities and international celebrities, really trying to popularize conservation as we've done in Asia, I think, quite successfully, taking it out of just sort of the government's hands into the mass public to get involved and engaged in it. That's what we're trying to do in Africa, to make people understand that obviously this is their natural heritage that's being stolen effectively. And the, you know, very often the poachers involved other types of crimes as well. And, you know, many of these countries, the highest or one of the highest sources of hard currency, which they're desperately short of in Zimbabwe right now, is tourism. And so they need the wildlife for a thriving tourism industry. So it's not just about saving the animals, which of course is a noble goal in itself, but it's also about preserving jobs, preserving the economy, and giving the economy a chance to grow. All those jobs involved in everything from taxi drivers to tourist guides to hotel employees, mainly being generated from wildlife in many of these countries. So it's an outreach campaign for that, to try and keep the politicians honest in keeping up the fight against poaching, and to also, you know, in some of these places there are serious problems with conflicts with wildlife. So whether it's lions killing cattle or elephants raiding fields, there's a big cost to some local people from having the wildlife there. And we're working and fighting for a bigger share of the tourism revenue to go to those communities, but also looking at different ways of deterring that kind of conflict with animals, whether it's using drones to scare away elephants. They often think that drones are bees, and they can be sometimes used to scare the elephants away. We've also been involved in helping develop a scent repellent that seems to turn elephants off and keep them away from crops that can be locally manufactured. So all of this is going on in Africa, and what we're trying to do is give conservation a bigger profile within those communities and within those countries, and also encourage the middle class in Africa, who very many people now in the African cities, a place like Nairobi and Harare, could actually afford to go on safari and go and see these animals. They have these amazing national parks right on their doorstep, and they've never been, and they've never seen it. And every time we take somebody, and very often it's local celebrities, they've never seen an elephant. When they do, it's a life-changing experience, and they become inspired and excited and proud that their country has these animals.
He's the CEO of Wild Aid, Peter Knights. Peter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Auntie Ballas, Fleetwood Mac, and Steel Pulse.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.